So there are several possible approaches to entering into the Gita. The most commonplace approach is to take out some nuggets which we find useful in our life. Now, that's okay. There are several books like that, Gita for everyday life, and you know, almost like, and they take out certain elements and things which are also very logical. For example, Nishkam Karma. So, as a youngster itself, I was wondering, well, whatever you may do, the fruit is never in your hands. So, very logically, to think about the fruit and do an action is bound to, you should do it well. You should do with the idea of success. But if you are worried about the fruit, we'll take away a lot of energy and put it in a direction which anyways you are not determining. This idea that whatever you are doing, that's how things will be. I think one has to just grow up looking at life and one understand that it's not really like that. Why is it so? We should try to understand. But normally what we do is we end up blaming God, complaining the system, or pass it on to karma or whatever else. But this is clear that life doesn't give, if I have done, it's not mathematics, not an ATM machine where you have put something and the result is according to your liking. You don't put money and pick up a Coca-Cola. That's not it. That's not how it operates. And that itself is a sign that it's not a mechanical system. It is something else which considers your requests and gives you not as per your request, but as per a different, greater law of being. So that itself is a sign that God exists, if nothing else. If life was, I have put this, I want this and I get that, then it's a arithmetic, then it's a mechanical system, like a machine, but it's not a machine exactly like that. But anyways, this is one approach. Second approach is, now in first approach, most of the important elements of Gita are out. Divine, offering to the divine, surrender, many of these are out. They just pick out certain aspects. Then the second approach is the classical one where one reads the text and, you know, goes by the word, and most of the time it's like a Gita part which you just receive it, accept it, there is a joy in it. But as we know that nothing is really understood unless it's practiced. Gita is a book of practice. So every little thing that we practice, we get to go deeper. But this is the third approach, and that's why my favorite essay on the Gita, because often people still go back to, okay, I'll read only the Sanskrit version. Nothing wrong with that. But when you take a close look at the Gita, there are questions which Arjun didn't raise, but which the modern mind will raise. Arjun didn't raise because Arjun's problem was not philosophical at all. Arjun's problem was, what do I do? Should I kill my kith and kin or not? This is his problem. Of course, it's Sri Krishna's the futuristic vision that he revealed the secret of action and all the forces that go into its making. But still, there are, one, the time is very short, so in, you know, 700 slokas or 699, whatever one may say, he had to reveal. It's a power-packed thing. But in the modern mind, questions will arise, and they should arise. That's how Krishna and Arjuna's samvad is like that. He has asked questions. Now, there is a difference between questions and doubt. Doubt is that I am fundamentally doubting. No, this is not true. That's obviously absurd. But question means, for example, one of my questions that used to be there as a youngster when I read the Gita, that if all is determined, then where is the scope of real free will? And if there is no free will in the real sense of the word, then what is this karma? Why should I be responsible for the karma if there is no real free will at all? It's an illusion given to us. So these used to be the questions, and it's only when we read essays on the Gita that these questions Sri Aurobindo has already anticipated. It's like Sri Krishna was holding back things. He has hinted, but he is holding back that, okay, Arjun, for your purposes I am saying, and for humanity at this stage of evolution. But it's going to become more and more mentalized and raise questions. I'm in a hurry right now, but I'll come back as Sri Aurobindo and reveal those things. So one of the questions that we have this, an important one, which if you read cursorily through the chapters of the Gita and all the Sanskrit sloka, as we know, there is that passing phrase. One is that yantra rudini maya. All creatures are bound by, you know, as a fly on the wheel. So you start questioning, then where is this free will? Is there a free will? And then he also says that, you know, it is a difficult thing to cross over. Maya, duratya. Even if I tell you that it is nature, you can't just cross over. Why? Because I am the one who has started the ball rolling. So these are issues which arise, that what really is free will. And Shurbindo starts saying, one of the ways people look at it is that at the origin there is a free will, all the rest is consequence. You made a choice, and based on the choice everything else unrolls. That's a very incomplete, unsatisfactory answer, because as we have seen in the previous chapter, determinism of nature, it is nature determining our so-called free choice. And it's very easy to understand. If we study our own book of life, every point when we made a choice, hundreds of choices that we make, what impels the choice? There is something which has conditioned us at that moment. Maybe a friend called and said, let's go out for dinner at this place. Okay, fine. So what conditioned my choice? Emotions. Do I have a trigger that I'll press the switch, which emotion will come up? No, I don't. Another point, somebody says that, well, let's go and have dinner, and there is a place, and my taste buds say no. A third point, I am just feeling too lazy that day, so I say no. At a fourth point, I want to have a good, healthy, balanced diet, and therefore I am saying yes or no. But where are all these ideas that have come into me? So if we look closely, we see that all the ideas, it just as an adolescent one can analyze these. That there is nothing which I can call as mine or myself. There is heredity, there is conditioning from parents, there is conditioning by society, education, all the things that have entered into me as information. I have churned them and I call it myself, me. If there is, this me is a conglomerate, then where is this me who is responsible at all? And if you see the strictly Buddhist doctrine, that's where it amounts to. It's like an onion peel. If you keep peeling, at the end of the onion, there is nothing. That's how people say. So the whole creation, choices, consequence, everything collapses. But the Gita brings in this element that no, there is something behind this apparent I. There is a soul which doesn't die with the body, which goes through the cycle. So logically, we should raise this question, what is this soul? Because there is so much of confusion about it. Many people think the soul is nothing but the mind, some part of the mind. That's what gives us the impression of a soul. Others think it's some kind of energy. Still others think it's synonymous with ghost. Thanks to the ghost stories, Atma, Atma, Atma. Others think that, well, soul is information which survives the body. None of this is true from the Gita standpoint and Shurbindo standpoint. So where is the origin of the soul? And that's where you have to go back to the origin of origins. The soul owes its origin to the divine. It is a part and parcel, a portion of the divine. Mamevansh, that's how Sri Krishna puts it. And who has formed this within the divine? Para Prakriti Jiva Bhuta. It is the divine mother who has manifested these portions within the being of the divine. In the life divine, he makes it very explicit, it's in the supermind. So that's where individual souls have their origin. Why they have been created, that is not discussed here, but that's because the one wanted to become many. So, okay, that's the origin of the soul. What about nature? Because we keep saying nature. What is nature? So first, Sri Krishna has described to us that first understand what is nature. Nature has three operating systems. So one operating system is tamas. When tamas is active, you feel sleepy, dull, lethargic, don't feel like doing anything, don't feel like listening anything, don't want to discuss anything, don't want to believe. I mean, you are happy in your comfort zone. That tamas applies at all levels. intellectual tamas is where we don't want to know anything. So vital tamas is you don't want to explore anything. Physical tamas, of course, we know that, you know, sleep and sleep and sleep. So this tamas, there is second operating system, because this operating system is meant to give rest to the organism. It preserves things. You have to allow some time to preserve things. So in a state of tamas, things are being assimilated. But then it cannot last forever, otherwise it will be like a material creation. So there is rajas. When rajas becomes active, a man becomes active. So he wants to do things, animals go hunting, the plants start seeking things. And it is the dynamic movement. It makes things move. And again, this movement can go to any extent. Ambition, everything is rajas. Emotions, seeking after another. All these are rajas elements. Because of rajas. But rajas has a tendency. It overcomes sattva. But what does it do? It can go overboard. It's like the man who started running. You have that story of Bodo. You must have known, you know. He was a donkey in the ashram, and there is a very interesting aside to it. Mother had seen the donkey and she had said, I want this. The donkey was standing with his owner in the balcony, below the balcony, in the balcony darshan. So he must have heard, so he also stood. The mother's eyes fell on the donkey and she told Dhiman Bhai that I want this donkey. And the donkey came and the donkey stopped working. And somebody complained to mother, Shurbindo, that this Bodo, she gave him a name Bodo. Bodo doesn't work. So Shurbindo remarked, typical sadhak. Now he's an ashramite, he doesn't work. He's enjoying life, but it doesn't work. So Bodo ran in a race. So Bodo was by nature tamas, so he is standing, it's a race, donkey race, actually held in Pondicherry. Bodo is just refusing to run with so many ashramites to cheer him. But he's not running, he's standing. All the donkeys are running. Then somebody had the wise thought of invoking the mother. You see, people have invoked mother in all kinds of things. Suddenly Bodo ran, and he ran so fast that he kept running beyond the... And he came first, of course. Now this is how rajas operates. When rajas starts, you don't know what to do. So comes sattva. Sattva is the one which balances. So he'll say, thus far and no further. So sattva puts limits, boundaries, rules, regulations, shastra. That's how it is. So this way we can understand everything in creation. Including food. There are foods which increase rajogun. The foods which increase tamogun. Foods which increase sattagun. That's how the Indian things work. That fresh fruits, juicy fruits, succulent ones, they increase sattagun. And very spicy food, meat, all this is rajogun. And refrigerated food, tamogun. So tamogun means tendency toward, proclivity towards violence, because you don't feel alive unless you are doing something extremely violent. So tamogun based societies become very drug prone and, you know, all these things. When you have no challenges in life, tamogun begins to take over. That's why difficulties in life are part of the solution. If you remove the difficulties, you have a better, greater problem. So all this way he explains the determinism of nature. So then who is this idea of self which comes in? So as I said, it's itself is a construct of nature. But is that the last truth? So what is this construct? In the morning it is one thing, evening another thing, night one thing. It's not a stable thing. So this state of self in which it is fluctuating, going along with the currents of nature. How many times we hear from people that, you know, in the morning they have decided something, that okay, in the evening we'll do it. And when you ask them that, what about evening? Sir, mood nahi hai. Mood nahi hai. That's as simple answer. What is mood nahi hai? You are supposed to be master of... A sattvic man will say, but you are supposed to be master of your mood. Nahi sir, man nahi hai abhi. That's the end of the story. So, this I, which is constantly changing within nature, this is the soul reflected as Sharobhav, Sharabhav, Sharapurusha. Shar is mutable, changing. Can't trust this Purusha. He is going with the flow of nature. Why this sense of self comes there? Sankhya explains that because there is a real Purusha. But he is, because he is involved in nature, the moods of nature gets reflected into him. Much like if I am watching a movie, so when there is a funny scene, I laugh. When there is a sad scene, some people laugh, some cry. Same with horror scenes, sometimes you laugh, but some people feel afraid. So you are identified and therefore you are experiencing creation because you are identified. But in the middle of that scene, which is whatever it is on the television screen, suddenly you get a phone. Now you see you have changed. You walk out. So according to Sankhya, there is a real Purusha, but when he is involved in this nature, he begins to behave as nature bids him to behave. He is identified with the becoming. So that is called Shar. Shar means that which is changing. So then Sankhya says, Buddhism will say, but you can, if you get rid of all this, there is nothing. There is no spectator. But Sankhya, that way, at least to me, it seems at least more logical. It says there is a spectator. So you can withdraw completely from all this becoming. And the example is again, somebody in the cinema hall suddenly goes into his reverie. Then you are cut off from all that is going outside. It's going on, but you are not involved in it. You are not engaged in it. So that is Akshara. So this is the second Purusha, Akshara. Akshara is like that which is changeless. It's immutable. So there are two status of the self. One is when it is caught in the becoming, flow and flux of things, which is the usual state. And the other, when it can withdraw from it and it experiences, one experiences the same self as a vast, impersonal, silent Brahman. This is an experience not difficult to have. If you really learn to witness, this is one of the meditations also, very beautiful meditations. Shobhinda even speaks about it. And Swami Vivekananda has spoken about it. To just be a witness. Not just to outer nature, but inner nature. Outer is one witness, but inner nature, all the thoughts, feelings. Don't react, don't involve, don't judge also. Don't say, oh, I am so horrible. No, nothing. You are not this high at all. So these things arise as wave and fall. Initially, you'll see them arising like this. Then if you don't give consent, they slowly become lesser and lesser, and one begins to enter into a state of inner peace and quietude. So that's how the Akshara Purusha is discovered. So that means there are two status of self. One when it is involved, the other when it is out. But they are like irreconcilable opposites. You can't be sitting in that state all the time as an internal witness. You have to act, you have to speak, you have to communicate. So how to reconcile them? So ascetics try to find a solution. They say better don't involve much except the minimum things. Minimum things are the daily things where you have to be involved. But beyond that, don't get involved. So you live more and more in the impersonal silent Brahman. And if you withdraw deep enough, you can go beyond, out of this. That's of course requires a strenuous practice. And for many days you have to be in that state. But it doesn't reconcile the problem. That's why Sankhya doesn't address this problem. It says there is nature. That's it. Why it is there? That's not your question. You can come out. There is this self inside. It's not a false self. But this is a self which is reflecting the moods of nature upon itself. So it thinks, I am this. I am good. I am bad. I am angry. I am hungry. I am depressed. I am jubilant. So I am the doer. And this we can understand, this sense of doer also of this self. So there are four poises one can take. One, this is my work and I am the doer. Sounds very good. I'll do it my way. Very good. Okay. Anyways, you'll do your way. Are you going to listen if somebody says, this is true of all humanity, by the way. That's why discussions and debates are so meaningless. Anyway, so what is the second point? Second point is that, well, I've been put here by the mother. Okay, sounds very good. But, so I have to do it. But I'll do it my way. And I'll do it. I mean, you have only just used the mother as a euphemism. Obviously, in a place like, you know, a spiritual place, you can always say, I've been put here by the mother. But you are still doing it your way. What can I do? I have to do it my way. Your way is nature is making you do. You are still acting under the determinisms of nature in the name of the mother. You are the same donkey. It's just that you are saying, I am mother's donkey, which is okay, that's good. Better than the first one. But you are still tied by the determinisms of nature. There is no real freedom. You are the same person as you would be anywhere else. That we see. When you go into people, you are the same person. Instead of you have changed the place and put on that other cap, mother sitting on top. But you are doing it and you further justify it because mother has put me here. So this is the second poise people take. Third is, mother is the doer. Now you see how things tend to change. But I have to just execute her will. This starts getting better because now I want to know what is mother's will. She is the doer. And then I say, mother is the doer. I have to just open to her and let her will flow through me. Her consciousness force flow through this being, which should be freed from all obstructions to her. And which is the biggest obstruction? The sense of myself as the ever-changing fellow. I am the obstruction. That's why the Gita says, Atmanev Atmano Bandhu, Atmanev Ribhu Atmana. When I am identified with the flow of this nature, then I cannot really be an instrument of the divine. Because I may say mother is the doer, but I am still acting according to my ignorance in the name of free will. So I have to somehow connect with the mother and I have to also learn to disengage from these changes. Learn to become a witness, but as we have seen, becoming witness is not enough. So we have to go to the third Purusha. In the Gita it is Purushottama. Purushottama reconciles. How does he reconcile? Nature has come out of Purushottama. That's how the Gita reconciles it by saying, this nature which you say, you are experiencing the determinisms of nature, nobody else has done it. I am the one who has put it. He says, my Maya, I am the one who has put this. And see, very beautifully we see it in this threefold nature in the triple soul forces. But this, in this nature which the divine has put out, how now we see there are two operating systems, the divine and the soul connected, and the divine nature which in the soul manifests as swabhava and swadharma. The divine self becoming through each individual center. Then it enters into the realm of me, not as the soul, but as Mr. So-and-so. The ego self. Then what happens? We have a best description is in Savitri, the triple soul forces. One where in its original poise, tamogun, which gives peace, endurance, perseverance. Rajogun, in its original sense, is a warrior against all that opposes the divine manifestation. Sattugun, in its original sense, is a bringer of light. But in the human ego, tamogun changes into tamas. Rajogun changes into me and mine. I will do this, I'll do that. And sattugun changes into I am the knower, I know, I'll do this, I can teach, I can preach. So that is the difference between, so that's what the Gita explains. So whereas when we step back from this shar purusha, enter into the Akshar Purusha, we begin to experience a fundamental liberation. But not yet the true I. True I comes when we go further into the Purushottama. That's where we discover, oh, I am a part and parcel of the Divine Mother. I am now using Purushottama in that sense. Yes, You have these three statuses, the mother in as the transcendent, the universal and the individual. Then I begin to discover the true self, individual self, not the ego self. I am no more Mr. So-and-so, a creation of the moment, of the hours. I no more suffer and rejoice. I am no more the doer because nature is the doer. This also doesn't require much thought. Everything, let's say one is speaking. So, inspiration has to come. Or those who memorize something, memory has to come. Or who are consulting notes, notes have to come. So, what all has gone into it, all the brain and eyes and everything. Then the brain has to take in this information. It has to come to the mouth through nerves. Everything, nature is the doer. If nature says no, nothing one can do. So, nature is the doer. And who is the one who is impelling nature? Master? It is the divine. So nature itself has two poises. One when it withdraws into the divine and becomes quiescent. So in the impersonal, Akshar Brahm, it's not that nature is not there. Nature is absorbed as if into the divine consciousness. So this is how one has to understand nature itself has been brought out by the divine, the unity of soul and nature. So in the lower creation, the individual soul, and again that same nature is operating within us. But in the origin, Sattva is not the way we understand, experience Sattva. In the origin, Sattva is the light and truth of the divine. Rajas is the conscious force of the divine. And Tamas is the self-existent peace of the divine. So that's how it is in its origin. Here it is experienced as the lower nature. So this is the background. Now we can just read some of the passages. So I always feel we should raise these questions otherwise. But before proceeding further, beyond the modes of nature. This is the title. Because this is what we have to discuss now. We are caught in the determinisms of nature. Is that the last word? No, you can go beyond. That is what is Trigunatit. So, once again, one way of withdrawing is that then I don't act. Because action is nature. I am just standing behind, I am a witness. But no, we have to act. Gita says you have to act. So how do I act? If I act, I will get involved into nature. No, says the Gita, there is another way of action. So we'll keep that for suspense. But for the moment, which I keep on saying, people keep on advocating all these, you know, unthinkingly, power of now. Sorry to say, some. What now? Say, if I am saying I will live in the present. Who is this I who is living in the present? You are at the mercy of nature. Living in the present moment, I may feel like slapping someone. So, animals live in the present. They don't care about future. They don't care about the past. So we must understand that it is. If you want to put it as a present, put it as the eternal present. Only under the impulsion of the divine, I will act each moment. If you remove that word, decapitated teaching, that's what I, is the word. If you remove the word eternal or the divine now, then just living in the now can be very confusing. Because I am a slave of nature. Where is I at all? So Aurobindo says very beautifully, chapter 22. We speak and act, the last four lines of the first passage. Page 224. We speak and act as if we were perfectly free in the pure and virgin moment to do what we will with ourselves using an absolute inward independence of choice. That's how we understand it. This now, I am free to choose. Hold on. Just let a phone call come and we'll see how free you are. And sometimes I feel it so strange. This kind of a commonplace thing is being compared to Sri Aurobindo's yoga. I mean, well, no further comments. Somebody gave me a book, invited me for the lecture. I said, what is this? This is something which as a 17-year-old I had understood. And I have understood its fallacies. You want me to hear a lecture on the power of now, and from there you can go on to, you have to bring in the divine element, otherwise nothing is explained. So it is like a mishmash of Buddhism and other things. Anyways, so pure and virgin moment to do what we will with ourselves, using an absolute inward independence of choice. But there is no such absolute liberty. Our choice has no such independence. That's the closure, which is so true. It doesn't require to read a book. It requires common sense. We are moved at the mercy of so many forces. At any given moment, even when we are sitting quietly, nobody to disturb us. There is, even not acting is a choice that nature makes in us. Of course, there is a deeper play behind it. It takes us from tamas to rajas to sattva and further. This is not revealed in the Gita. That's why not all the things are yet revealed in the Gita. This is revealed in the secret knowledge. Savitri is the completest teaching. There it is revealed. Why this play? Because this is a natural question. Who put me here? Why have you put me into this trouble? So there we see that how nature, it's like kindergarten, where you have to obey completely the teacher. Not kindergarten, up to primary school. Then higher secondary, where there is certain freedom, projects, all this. You take enthusiasm, interest. If you take enthusiasm, interest, you do things. If you don't take enthusiasm, interest, you don't. Then comes the graduation, where you are given a subject, a scope, and you do. Then you can come back as a teacher, you are free in that sense, in a certain sense. You have done your... So, tamas, rajas, sattva. And the sense of I, which is not true I, which arises as a result of their action, prepares us ultimately. Because after Satgun, one begins to wonder, what is beyond this boundary? What is beyond the scripture? What is beyond all that I can conceive of? So that's when the spiritual journey begins. So this is one of the sutra. But at the same time, nature does it with a purpose. Page 225, fourth line from above. And error or not, illusion or not, this idea of our will, of our action, is not a thing of no consequence, of no utility. Everything in nature has a consequence and a utility. So the Gita hints at it in this way, that slowly this is the way we evolve. And if we act according to sattva, we are better prepared. Later on it will explain in Devasuri Sampada, which of these poises is best, but we can leave it for later. So what is she doing through this process? It is rather that process of our conscious being by which nature in us becomes more and more aware of and responsive to the presence of the secret Purusha within her, and opens by that increase of knowledge to a greater possibility of action. It is by the aid of the ego idea and the personal will that she raises herself to her own higher possibilities. So she is the one creating the sense of my will to discover herself. That's how, you know, when we look at many of the tantric literature, now I'm resisting the temptation to go into that. Uma is creating, but she is holding Shiva in her heart. If you look at nature, everything that she builds, in her heart it is the Purusha. She builds mountains to bring out that majesty of the Purusha. She creates galaxies to bring out the cosmic whirl of the Sudarshan Chakra. Sometimes you look at them, it's like a bed of light, Shir Sagar. Then she creates the atom to bring out the truth that he dwells in the smallest of movements. So she tries to make the smallest, smallest, smallest. And the divine inhabits even the minutest abode. She creates wonders. If you look at it, rivers. Everything in creation is, she is trying to bring out some aspect of the Purusha. That's how the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad describes the great horse. So the whole creation is seen in the image of the great horse. And it's called as Ashwamedha Yajna, comes from that, the great sacrifice of the great horse. But that's going into a beautiful but another subject. So, few lines below, the sense of free will, illusion or not, is a necessary machinery of the action of nature, necessary for man during his progress, and it would be disastrous for him to love it, lose it, before he is ready for a higher truth. So it applies in our teaching when we use the word free, freedom. So some people start saying, okay, fine, 3-year-old has a freedom. And it goes to this level. One of the challenges in Australia, I was having a discussion. You're free to decide whether you are a boy or a girl or a tree or a snake. Fellow doesn't know. You have not empowered him what it means to be a tree. He will go by fancy. Now I'm a tree. Now I'm a boy. Now it becomes a game. See, you have to empower. That's not an age when there is absolute freedom. There is a very... absolute freedom is not nowhere. But that's how we had a very simple education-wise in India, a very ancient knowledge, this thing. Up to the 5, you have to tell the child, this is how things have to be done. You have to train him, teach him. 5 to 15, he becomes a student. So you are interacting, dealing, slowly learning, growing, you're there. 15 onwards, you are a friend, you are still there. So freedom is something you grow, you are there, but I'm not saying one should never use a stick or harsh words, but you have to teach certain basic boundaries, certain basic things, and then slowly, that's how nature operates. It's the way nature operates and God operates. So we have to pick up from there that these are the 3 classes through which we have to pass. Tamas. Similarly, if a person is in tamas, your action with that person has to be very different than when a person is in sattugun. If a person is in tamas and you try to tell him, sir, please don't be like this, it's not, you are not being very kind, he will laugh at you. He'll say, yes, I am enjoying this game. If you tell a sattvic man, sir, yes, I understand, yes, it was a mistake. I probably was a bit loud and harsh. See the difference? You can't treat everybody the same way. Tamogun pradhan, person who is living in utter tamas, and you start telling him that, you know, this or that, he will say, I don't care. He'll pick up probably a stone and throw at you. So we have to understand this. It has many practical implications. And then Sri Aurobindo says, the sense of I is not a sheer delusion. It is only an error of standpoint and an error of placement. The ego thinks that it is the real self and acts as if it were the true center of action and as if all existed for its sake. And there it commits an error of standpoint and placement. Why? Because the ego self doesn't receive impulsion from the divine but is driven by the nature. So it thinks everything according to my standpoint. I am correct. I am Mr. Right. And it can go to any extent. Others, all nature is meant only for me. That's what we see in Triple Soul Forces. It is not wrong in thinking that there is something or someone within ourselves, within this action of our nature, who is the true center of its action and for whom all exist. But this is not the ego, it is the Lord secret within our hearts, the divine Purusha and the Jiva other than ego, who is a portion of his being. So he's already given us the true image of what's inside. Beyond nature, within us, behind this working of nature, there is the Lord holding our soul in his lap. That's why you see one of the things, the image that comes of mother, the child putting his head in the mother's lap. This is an image of the truth of within. Mother holding the child in her arms. That's what we see in some of those, you know, images of Mother Mary holding baby Jesus. Such a beautiful. But we have forgotten the meaning of these images. Holding baby Jesus in her arms. And then the 7 stabs, the 7, sufferings that she undergoes. She undertakes upon herself these sufferings that the soul has to undergo in its evolutionary journey. The 7 sorrows, all that is there in Savitri. Not here, but this is the real image we should concentrate upon. It gives us also an image, mother in my heart and the Jiva, the true self in her lap. When Sahanadi asked the mother, Sri Aurobindo, I don't know how to meditate. I imagine I am in mother's lap. sitting in mother's lap. So Sri Aurobindo says it is one of the best possible forms of meditation. But because he gave this sentence without charging any dollars, without the, I am going to teach you meditation over the next 5 days with such fees and with lot of fanfare, lot of expectations. So people don't value. Just meditate one day with this, I mean the mother's lap. Not this outer me, but inside, even this we can. But the divine mother and in the heart, I am at her feet or in her lap. Life will become so. Because this is the secret truth. The self-assertion of ego sense is the broken and distorted shadow in our minds of the truth that there is a real self within us, which is the master of all and for whom and at whose behest nature goes about her work. So what happens is that when we are subject to nature with the ego self, we are not masters, we are slaves, nature drives us and we go. But when we discover the true self, which is a portion of the divine, then nature begins to obey. This is the difference. Because now nature knows he is, it's like when a child is studying in a school, he better listen to the teacher. But supposing the same subject he has studied and become, you know, a master in a particular subject, when he comes back and says, say, let's say physics, then the teachers in physics listen. That's the difference. And when we discover this true poise. Of course, then you don't say because of egoistic sense. You do it impelled by the divine. And that's what he emphasizes, page 226, second passage. The rejection of the idea of egoistic free will does not imply a cessation of action, because nature is the doer and carries out her action after this machinery is dispensed with, even as she did before it came into usage in the process of her evolution. So this is where people very often say that you escape, nature will continue with her own. But this is not what we are. I mean, this doesn't solve the problem of creation. So we'll come to the ways to solve. So one of them, page 227, he says that you discover, when you step back and discover the Akshar Purusha, you discover the Akarta. So there is the Karta Purush. If you take the Sikh doctrine, they use the word Karta Purush. Karta Purush is the soul which is in the becoming. It believes I am the doer. And the Akarta, which is stepping back into that impersonal self. But the true Karta, the true doer is the divine. He is the real, ultimately all actions come from him. So, but all these are stages through which one goes. Page 227. If then a man casts from him the idea of himself as the doer or of the works as his, if as the Gita enjoins, he fixes himself in the view of himself as the inactive non-doer, Atmanam Akartaram, and all action as not his own but nature's, as the play of her gunas, will not a like result follow? The Sankhya Purush is the giver of the sanction, but a passive sanction only, Anumati. The work is entirely nature's. Essentially, he is the witness and sustainer, not the governing and active consciousness of the universal Godhead. This is the Sankhya way. It can give you liberation, but nothing more. But here there is a work to do. That's where why Sri Aurobindo is revealing this to us at great length. And classic example of this state is that Dara would sit in his room and meditate with cigarettes in both the hands and in one hand and mosquito coils in the 2 feet. And window is open. And suddenly somebody entered the room and saw his shirts were being stolen by someone. Because window was open, shirts were hanging, and a very smart fellow will put, you know, that hook, pick up a shirt, and he's watching, what is happening? Then the second shirt, then the third shirt. So suddenly he said, Dara, do you see? He says, yes, I'm seeing. My shirts are being stolen. So what are you doing? No. He's just enjoying, he's watching, he's a witness. And if you look at from one standpoint, it gives you a freedom. But that doesn't solve the, how do I act in that case? So it is like as the mechanisms of nature will take me, impel me, but I am untouched. So this is one way of looking at it. But this is not the final truth. So we'll go to what is the real thing that we need to know. Page 229, last four lines. The soul of man, when it takes the poise of the shara, identifies itself with the play of personality and readily clouds its self-knowledge with the ego sense in nature. So that he thinks of himself as the ego doer of work. So this is the shara. When he goes into it, he forgets who he is. When it takes its poise in the akshara, it identifies itself with the impersonal and is aware of nature as the doer and itself as the inactive witnessing self. Akartaram. So these are the two which... Then the next paragraph. But these two, the status and immutability of the soul and the action of the soul and its mutability in nature actually coexist. Now this is the... That all the time this goes on together. We can switch the poise. Just a question of predominance. But the impersonal and the personal are always there. They are coexisting. It's just that depending on where I stress the sense of I, that's all that makes a difference. So, Shubhendu says this coexists because of the Purushottam. That's where on page 230 he brings this idea. We have seen that the Gita finds this, we'll just continue, actually coexist. And this would be an anomaly irreconcilable except by some such theory as that of Maya or else of a double and divided being. If there were not a supreme reality of the soul's existence, of which these are the two contrary aspects, but which is limited by neither of them. We have seen that the Gita finds this in the Purushottama. The supreme soul is the Ishvara, God, the master of all being, Sarva Loka Maheshwara. So now we see that there are these several poises. When the soul is completely identified with nature, it is Anish. It is not Lord. That's how Anish. It's slave of nature. Then when it steps back, it becomes the Sakshi and the Anumanta. It's sanctioning. If it refuses to sanction, turns away completely, after a while it will stop. There is a truth in it. So it becomes the Anumanta, the sanctioner. But this is not the highest truth. The highest truth is it is Ishvara. Lord of nature. The Lord of nature is not just a witness. Lord of nature is where he begins to direct the forces of nature. But no more by the ego self, which is itself part of nature, but by the greater self, by discovery of the true poise of the soul as free within the consciousness of the divine. So page 231, he must, to be free, get back from the nature, second paragraph, he must, to be free, get back from the nature action to the status of the akshara. He will then be trigunatit, beyond the gunas. Knowing himself as the akshar Brahman, the unchanging Purusha, he will know himself as an immutable, impersonal self, the Atman, tranquilly observing and impartially supporting the action. But himself calm, indifferent, untouched, motionless, pure, one with all beings in their self, nor not one with nature and her workings. So this is the where the Upanishads can take us. It cannot take us to the beyond. Is there a beyond? Yes, there is a beyond. This self, though by its presence authorizing the works of nature, though by its all-pervading existence, supporting and consenting to them, Prabhu, Vibhu, does not itself create works or the state of the doer or the joining of the works to their fruit, but only watches nature in the shara working out these things. So it makes you free of the action and consequences because you are nirlipt, you are not attached. Things are happening, you are doing, but you are doing as a witness. Because you know you are not the doer, nature is doing it. So we'll come to that. Yeah. Last four lines on this page. By going back into the impersonal self, the soul gets back into a greater self-knowledge and is liberated from the bondage of the works of nature. Untouched by her gunas, free from our shows of good and evil, suffering and happiness. Because you know you are not the doer, nature is doing in us, you are completely detached from the workings. This is a state one can try practice even for an hour, whatever it is, and one can see that how one is unaffected by whatever is happening. For instance, one can be somewhere, you know, any activity. That's why one of the basic practices in yoga is, as the mother says, take pleasure in all you do, but do not do anything for the sake of pleasure. When you're doing anything, because, you know, it has come your way. So neither, oh my God, drudgery, I have to do this work. There you are the doer. And that's why this little change. Actually, Shubhendra and the mother teachers take us to the final stage. That it is not your work, it is mother's work. And mother is doing it, you have to just be open. Then you are a free being. But the Gita takes us through these steps. Page 232. Is this the last state, the utmost possibility, that is the Shar and Akshar, the highest secret? It cannot be, since this is a mixed or divided, not a perfectly harmonized status. Nobody can be swinging between these two states. A double, not a unified being. A freedom in the soul and imperfection in the nature. It can only be a stage. What then is there beyond it? One solution is that of the sannyasin, who rejects the nature, the action altogether. So far at least as action can be rejected, means certain things he will continue, so that there may be an unmixed, undivided freedom. But this solution, though admitted, is not preferred by the Gita. So what does the sannyasi do? Minimum actions. Nityakarm, that's how why it is called as Nityakarm in Sanskrit. There are things you have to do. You have to wake up, you have to maybe not brush your teeth, but maybe take a shower, or who knows. Minimum action, elimination, that you have to do. Eat food just to survive. So many of these sannyasi go to that extreme. Because they say that it's all nature. Why should I engage myself in nature at all? Except the bare minimum. Some even give up food and everything and arrive at a state of nirvana. But that's not the solution Gita is suggesting. And that makes a mockery of the world play. But we have to understand the logic behind it. So it is not preferred by the Gita. The Gita also insists on the giving up of actions. Sarva karmani sannyas, but inwardly to the Brahman. Brahman is the Shar. In the Shar supports only the action of Prakriti. Brahman in the Akshar, even while supporting, dissociates itself from the action, preserves its freedom. The individual soul, unified with the Brahman in the Akshar, is free and dissociated, yet unified with the Brahman in the Shara, supports but is not affected. This it can do best when it sees that both are aspects of the one Purushottama. So you can imagine a person who owns a company. What does he do? He is also taking up, he is doing a work in it. He is owning, so there he is the ultimate boss. But he is doing a particular work. Let's say he is specialized in production. So in the production, he is also the head. But as the owner, there are several people who are working. So they are going about doing their own work. So all of them, he is supporting just by being present there. Because he has sanction. His tacit sanction is there. So there is the tacit sanction of the Purushottama Brahman in all this work. He is in a way involved in it. But at the same time, he is out of it. So this is how one has to look at all the three status that exist together. But the first two cannot be reconciled. If this man is only a production manager, then, you know, he cannot, you cannot say that other works are also, he is a sanctioner. He cannot be. Or if he sanctions, then he is specifically in doing these sanctions. He has been given this task of sanctioning. But when he is the owner, then he is free as well as the doer, as well as the sanctioner, all these things at the same time. So we have to see ourselves as the Purushottama inhabiting all existences, as the secret Ishwara, controls the nature and by his will, now no longer distorted and disfigured by the ego sense. The nature works out the actions by the Subhava. The individual soul makes the divinized natural being, an instrument of the divine will, nimitta matram. So now what happens when we begin to discover that we are neither Shar nor only Akshar, but we are portions of the Divine Mother. I am using now Divine Mother because it becomes contextual. I am part and parcel of the Divine Mother. Then what happens? Then she pours her action through the fundamental nature. Actually she goes even beyond it, but let's for the moment. Swabhava and the Sudharma. Purushottama acts according to Swabhava and Sudharma. But the Divine Mother is in utter freedom. She can do anything, use anything, any material. It's something which some of the Tantra Shastras mention, that if you worship the Ishvara, he will give you the fruit according to your sadhana, the limited fruit. So, like that. But if you worship the Divine Mother, then she can grant you anything depending upon her will, because all creation is hers. So, you can't anymore say that according to my Swadharma, she can change the whole machinery. That's why plasticity in the supramental creation. But let's not exceed the brief of the Gita. So what does the Purushottama do? He pours into the soul the Swabhava and Sudharma. Based on that you act. But because you know you are not the doer, you are untouched by the consequences of this action. Why? Because you are acting on behalf of the divine. Nimitta matram. It is a practical thing even in everyday life. When you are acting on behalf of someone, say you are doing a work where you have been placed to do a work, then focus on that. The consequences are the other person's. But if you think I am the one who is responsible, then you take the consequences. So when you do a work with this idea that it is the Divine Mother and she is the doer, let her inspire me. I'll open to her and let her inspire me. Fill me with, and for that, the necessary condition of inner peace and quietude. As she moves my heart, so will I act. Then you may engage in a battle. You don't have the consequences. Precisely because you are a nimit matram, bhava sabhisachi, and she is pouring through you and doing what she has to do. But the sign will be perfect equality. You don't, after the action, say, when people say, oh, it was so wonderful. Yeah, yeah, I know. Yeah. I'm a good instrument. So silly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Or sometimes people say with humility, Mother has made me an instrument. She can create millions of instruments. What is there? She can pick up a pebble and change it into a star. That's her glory. And Vivekananda, people were saying, oh, wonderful. He said, you know, my guru, he can create 1,000 Vivekanandas. That is the truth. It's not a matter of speaking. It is the truth. She can pick up. In Savitri, there is a line, no, that all was lit into miracle shapes. Even here, the prostrate soil bore the awakening ray. And this common clay was lit into miracle. She can do that. But if the clay begins to think, my glory, the night will come. Hold on. But he who lives in the glory of the Divine Mother is always day, regardless of what's happening in the outside world. So this is the secret we are here to learn. And this will start with a set of attitudes in practice. Whenever we are flowing into the Shar, we have to remind ourselves, look here. You think it's your choice? Hold on. Is it your ego or is it a true inspiration? Wait. So you learn to step back into the Akshara. And invoke the Divine Mother. That's why remember and offer is such a good practice. So slowly, slowly she will start taking over. In the beginning it's a practice. Slowly she'll begin to take over. When she takes over, then nothing has to be done. Then you are a puppet in her hands. What she, you know, the line in Ramcharitmanas, Sabahi Nachavat Ram Gusai. The Lord is making you dance, you dance. He makes you sit quiet, you sit. So that's where we have to reach. And then the consequences are no more ours. So nimitta matram. What it means to be an instrument of the divine. Look here. I mean, it's not like anybody becomes an instrument of the divine because you are doing a work which has been assigned. It's a stage in which one has to enter. Last few lines. Nimitta matram. He remains even in action trigunatit. Because he doesn't have to abandon. Nature is his, Work is his, doer is he, the Lord is he. You are simply sitting in his lap and letting him flow through whatever instrumental personality nature has created for the moment and the work. Complete freedom. He remains even in action Trigunatit, beyond the gunas, free from the gunas, nistregunya. He fulfills entirely at last the early injunction of the Gita, nistregunyo bhavarjuna. He is indeed still the enjoyer of the gunas, as is the Brahman, though not limited by them, nirgunam gunabhoktaram. So he is enjoying in the battle, the hiss of the sword and the clash. He's enjoying. But he's not affected by them. Because it is the divine who is acting through this whole being which the divine has prepared. Last three lines. For he has unified his whole being in the Purushottama. This is the condition. Has assumed the divine being and the higher divine nature of becoming. Madbhav. He is full of the divine. He doesn't even know that this is what has happened. Because it's not he who is the doer. Has unified even his mind and natural consciousness with the divine. Manmana ma chitta. This change is the final evolution of the nature and the consummation of the divine birth. Rahasyam uttamam. So by the divine birth, which we read, this becomes possible. When it is accomplished, the soul is aware of itself as the master of its nature. It's a delegate mastery. It knows itself as the master. On behalf of the divine master, it is acting. And grown in light of the divine light and will of the divine will, is able to change its natural workings into a divine action. See how far the Gita can take us. It's almost touching on the borders of the transformation. That's why this whole thing from the Gita comes even in the last chapter of the Life Divine. Last two chapters, the Gnostic being. And this is the state one has reached. Then the rest is a question of just a matter of time. You have already started. She is pouring. So when she pours, what will happen? The instruments automatically start getting tuned, tweaked, changed, transformed. Just can't help it. So it's wonderful. We'll meet in November 13th November.